Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Werke, Judge Tracy Smith, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is May 28, 2025. This panel of the court today has five cases on its calendar, two of which will be submitted with oral argument and three of which will be submitted without oral argument, solely on the briefs. The first case set for oral argument is case number A24-1407, Mark S. Steinmetz versus Darlene D. Steinmetz. I believe counsel are familiar with our procedures. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. At the beginning, please identify yourself and your client. Our lectern is adjustable up and down. There are two buttons on the front edge of the surface that can be pressed to make it go. A motor will do it automatically. So, counsel for appellant, you may approach and begin.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Michelle Kuhl and I represent the appellant Mark Steinmetz. There are a few different ways that the court could approach this case, but the simplest one is that the trial court erred when it failed to impute $7,000 of investment income to wife, which it had previously done consistently for 20 years since their dissolution. And with that $7,000 of imputed income to her, she has no further need for spousal maintenance, and the district court should have granted husband's motion to terminate it.
Ms. Kuhl, am I correct that the analysis begins with the question whether there's a substantial change in circumstances?
Well,
go ahead.
So, yes, there has to, under the statute, for a motion to modify spousal maintenance, there's a substantial change in circumstances, which here would be the retirement of both parties, thus the receipt of retirement income by wife, and also the lack of employment income by husband.
The district court, I think, on that issue said there is not a substantial change because his income has not decreased. I'm paraphrasing, of course. That was the sole question that the district court asked and answered, I think. And potentially it could be change in either party's income or expenses, but the district court asked only the question whether his income had gone down and concluded it had not. And so I'm wondering whether, you know, for example, you lead off with the argument about her $7,000 of imputed investment income, but I'm wondering if we, well, first of all, whether I question that whether we should start there, and then I wonder whether we need to get there, but I think it depends upon what arguments were made below, and maybe you can explain further.
Sure. So husband definitely made the argument below that she has no need for maintenance because of her receipt of these additional retirement sources.
Okay, let me be specific. Did husband argue below that there is a substantial change in circumstances because her income has, because her expenses have gone down? Or because there's been a substantial change in either her expenses or her income?
I believe he did. I think it's perhaps talked about as kind of overlapping because the reality is we've reached retirement age, both parties have retired. That's a substantial change in circumstances. And so I do think that the trial court in its order was talking about her income as well. I mean, it talks about the income that she has from the pension and the Social Security, and then says that's not enough to meet her needs. So I think there's enough there that the court should consider the issue of the investment income in deciding this appeal?
Well, the statute, I mean, if we start with, just to focus a little bit more on it, the statute says one of the following changes circumstances: substantially increased or decreased need of an obligee. I think that's the part you're on. Substantially
Correct.
Increased need. It's not that there's been a retirement. You know, there can be retirement with no change in need. You know, and so, like, the need will be your expenses and your income, right? Gives you your need.
Right. I mean, it's right? the retirement that reduced the need, yeah.
Okay. And I mean, the concern I have and is that the neither below nor, I think, on the appellate brief really uses, relative to the first part of the argument, that framing of substantial increase or decreased need. But you're, like, looking at the elements of figuring out what that need is and then saying, I guess we should infer that, and the district court should infer that there's an argument that her need has substantially changed. But I don't really see the court. You just said the court found that she still has need, et cetera. Where in the findings of the district court now do you see a ruling on whether he proved that she has a substantially decreased need? I see that in paragraph seven, it talks about her pension and employment income. It says Social Security, et cetera. And it says she asserts that her reasonable monthly expenses are $10,720. Where's the finding that the district court made that there was no substantial change in her need?
Well, I mean, I think that it is in paragraph 7 where it's saying that this is the sources of income that she has available to access. It says that that's the expenses that she has.
That she asserts.
That she asserts.
Asserts, okay.
Right. And then you do the math from that, and that is where the court apparently found that she has continued need, because the only income that it considered was the pension and the Social Security, and that's less than the expenses that she asserted. So that's what the court's reasoning was from this order. I mean, I would have liked it to be more detailed.
Inferring that reasoning from her, it's reciting what her assertion of budget is. It didn't make a finding about her budget. I mean, is that fair to say? Or are you saying it implicitly did, and we should infer that it did math and that it made a finding on no substantial change in need, which seems like a lot. I mean, it was very explicit about the no substantial change in circumstances relative to, in paragraph 10, relative to his income. But the other side, relative to her need, I think you're inferring findings, right?
Well, I mean, I think that's the only way that the trial court could have gotten to its conclusion, because it was an argument made that she has no need for spousal maintenance. And so if the court had not concluded that she still has need, it couldn't have reached the decision that it did.
I disagree. I mean, the conclusion, paragraph 10, I mean, the topic sentence is, husband has not met his burden of showing a substantial change in circumstances. And then it proceeds to discuss only one issue, his income. And that paragraph by itself is sufficient to support the district court's conclusion to deny the motion, right?
No, not if there was two changes of circumstances argued, both the reduction in need by her and the reduced in income by him. The trial court would have had to decide both of those issues.
Then why didn't you argue that the district court erred by not addressing the second argument? I mean, if he made two arguments below, I mean, and the district court denied one and missed the other, I would have expected you to make that argument that the district court erred by completely omitting any analysis of the second argument.
I mean, we've discussed extensively in our brief the issue of her not having the need for spousal maintenance, and that was error for the trial court to not impute that investment income to her, and with that, the trial court could not have reached the conclusion that it did. So I disagree that it wasn't properly argued.
I mean, I don't see the word substantial change in circumstance anywhere in Section 1, the first argument below or here. You know, it's asking a lot of work to infer, I think, the factual findings that led to that conclusion, and then there's no, it's not directly addressed in that way. That's my, I don't really see the court rejecting or not rejecting her budget, rejecting or not rejecting her, the imputed income. I just don't see the analysis going there. It just turned to his income.
Well, and that's part of the problem, of course, that we, the problem is that the court didn't consider the additional investment income that it should have considered. The problem is that it didn't, you know, make the reductions to her budget of the mortgage, which had previously been ruled to be her responsibility, and the attorney's fees that are routinely removed.
Would that be a factual finding that the district court should have made as to whether there's a substantial change in circumstances relative to her need?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a factual finding of whether there's a substantial change in circumstances, and here it's clear error for the court not to make that finding under
so
on this record.
Is that a remand? You don't ask for a remand if it omitted a key issue presented to it that it should have decided. Should it be remanded for a decision on that?
I think on this record there can only be one conclusion because of the math. It's obvious that she has sufficient income to meet her expenses. So I don't think a remand is necessary when there can be only one conclusion. Obviously, if the court disagrees, then a remand could occur, and we can make that argument again at the district court.
I think at the district court, and I think it's referenced again on appeal, is that in 2016, the district court, in considering, you know, because that's the comparison. Do you agree that it should be compared to 2016? I want to understand that.
Yes, that's okay. The last order.
Okay. And so if one makes a comparison with the last order, that in 2016 there was, in determining need, I think the district court imputed $7,000 of income but did not include in her income in determining need her employment income of 20 plus or 2,000 plus a month, I think. And then here you're saying, okay, here, though, you should include the $7,000 imputed district court should have, and should include the employment and pension, or excuse me, the pension and Social Security. And I think that wife says, no, those, just as her income should have been, was excluded in 2016, so should her employment income, so should these other sources. But the district court didn't, those are the arguments I saw made in the trial court. I don't see a ruling on that one way or another. You're asking us to decide, it seems to me, that issue, and to say as a matter of law, her income is X, and that's a change.
Well, correct. I mean, the difference is that the employment income, the court said you can't count that because she's just making up for the failure to achieve the investment income. But the pension and the Social Security, she was always going to get when she retired. That's not making up for the failure of the investment income. And notably, we never argued in this most recent motion that you shouldn't count her employment income. She can still work. We won't count that. But the pension and the Social Security income was always going to be given, was always expected. And so that's not something that the court should exclude the same way that it excluded her employment income in 2016.
Can we go to the other issue, which is then paragraph 10, which is a substantial change of circumstances relative to income? I think your argument is, it strikes me that your argument is that the only income that's relevant to the question of whether he has substantially decreased gross income under the statute, the only relevant income, it seems that you're arguing, is employment income. And wife says, just look even at his tax returns. I think the most recent was probably 2022 at the time this, is that right, at the time of this hearing?
I believe so, yeah.
That even there he had lots of non-employment, non-W-2 income. What is the, are you arguing that all of the other income is not gross income under the statute, and why?
Because it comes from two sources. It comes from marital assets that were awarded to him in the dissolution, which this court has repeatedly said you can't count for spousal maintenance.
All right, stop there. When have we said you can't count the income on marital property? The income on it, not the asset themselves, but the income on the asset.
Well, there's been no, the other thing is that there's been no evidence here that he's receiving income on it. So we had an expert at trial in 2002 that opined on the income that she could receive from her investment income. But there was never any sort of evidence about any income that he would be receiving on his assets. And he's explained, no, actually my assets have been decreasing recent years. And there's nothing to contradict that.
So that's an evidentiary question, but in terms of the legal question, is there case law that we should be looking at that doesn't look at the assets themselves, whether they're postmarital or marital, and as opposed to the income on those assets? What's the authority that we can't consider those?
I think it necessarily follows from the fact that you can't consider the assets, because that would, if you were to adopt a rule that you can consider the income, then that hamstrings him in his ability to use his assets as he sees fit. And he should be able to use his assets that were awarded to him in the dissolution, and the assets that he acquired as non-marital assets after the dissolution. He should have the ability to use those as he sees fit, and she does not have the ability to require him to use them in any particular way that would generate income for wife. They're his assets, and so.
So when the tax returns show, one of wife's arguments, I think, at the hearing was, look at the 2022 tax return. It shows $646,000 in non-W-2 sources of income in his income taxes. I don't know if you agree with that number. I didn't quite see how that number came when I looked at the tax return, but that's not that relevant. I don't know. Let's say it's in the hundreds of thousands, and maybe it's exactly that. Why wouldn't that income be considered?
So the 2022 tax return, I saw adjusted gross income of $117,000, and that was when he was still employed for part of the year.
Isn't adjusted after deductions?
I don't know. I don't have the income statement. But regardless, he's explained extensively what his income is, and really wife just offers speculation in that he could obtain more in some other way, and that's what the district court relied on, and that would be error.
Judge Smith, do you have any additional questions? No. I'm curious. I know there is district court referred to the fact that he received a $15 million payment, I think, in exchange, I think, for equity in a company, I'm assuming. Do we know the date of that exactly? In other words, was it, I'm wondering if it was during or before or after 2022?
It was before. I believe it was 2020 and 2021.
And then the purchase of a $5-plus million home, do we know what year that was?
I don't recall what year, but to be clear, he sold his old home, bought a new one. So.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent. You may approach. Please identify yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
Yeah, may it please the court. My name is Richard Escala, and my client is Darlene Steinmetz, who's in the gallery. May it please the court and counsel. I would definitely would agree that this is a case involving a modification of spousal maintenance. There are two criteria which both must be met. It must be a significant change in circumstance, which makes the original award or the order in place since last time was considered unreasonable and unfair. And in this case, we believe that the trial court was accurate and it made the right decision in its decision, and the court should affirm that decision. In order to, as the court's indicated, I guess I also want to ask the court, would you like me to address our appeal also, or first, or would I respond to there?
In whichever order you wish, and of course you need not discuss all issues in your oral argument. You can focus your argument on whatever you wish.
Thank you. With respect to the response to the appellant's argument, clearly the really only change in circumstance in this case is the claim that he's retired. Now, clearly retirement can be a factor, but it's not determinative. You have to look at all the circumstances. The trial court did that in reaching its decision, and we believe the court was correct in its decision.
Can I stop you there? So I guess I'm wondering whether there was an argument made in the district court that there was a substantial change in her circumstances. Was that at issue in the district court?
I don't believe that was at issue due to the fact that the court indicated that the her income hadn't changed. The court basically replaced, it looked like the court replaced, not specifically, her part-time income with the Social Security and retirement income. In dealing with the issue of imputing income, which counsel has brought up, that was determined way back about 2002. The court did consider that in 2016. If you look at its decision, it considered that the imputed income was considered and reached the conclusion that based on the other circumstance, which I'll get to in a moment.
So my question is not so much about the district court's findings or analysis, I'm just wondering what issues were presented to the district court, whether when the argument was made for a modification, whether the moving party, Mr. Steinmetz, argued that there was a substantial change in circumstances because of his retirement or in addition because of a change in her circumstances?
I think he argued both, but I believe that the trial court in this case indicated that because of the circumstances that the income of the appellant was the major issue, and I think that's reflected in the court's findings. As has been indicated in this case, the court found that the appellant is a multimillionaire. He has a minimum of $22 million in assets. He received a $15 million payment in 2020.
Ms. Kuhl argued, and it's kind of follow-up to Judge Smith's question, but Ms. Kuhl argued that we should never include income that's generated from an asset that was awarded as a part of the dissolution proceedings. Can you tell me why we would include that income?
Well, I'm relying on the income that was, most of the income that we're talking about was earned from post-decree. And so if asset is during the marital dissolution, that asset should not be considered.
Not the asset, but income is generated from that asset.
The income would not be considered. I refer to the Lee case and the Krushel case, which I've cited, which indicates that the income from marital assets would not be included, but post-marital would. And
this was, again, just his business savvy and what he was able to do and generate after the fact?
Absolutely. He was involved in the cannabis business, and as the court indicated, he has multiple ownership.
Things that were outside of what was distributed during the marriage?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And the court considered the $50 million payment. He bought a new home for $5.25 million in, I believe, 2000 or 2001 before the motion. His net worth, he had two houses before that. Both were over $2 million. He stated in his documents, motion documents, and in this case, his expenses monthly were about $28,000 per month. That was his living expenses. So clearly, the appellant had plenty of resources and income to
is the issue, though, right?
Excuse me?
You said resources and income. I mean, what we're looking at, I just keep going back to the statute, is a substantially decreased gross income of the obligor. And the question is, what is his income? And did the district court's finding that was not shown, is that clearly erroneous? I think that's the issue. Not just whether, because he doesn't, I mean, unless you argue he does have to dip into actually sell off assets, dip into principal, et cetera.
No, we're not saying that at all. We're saying his income from those non-marital resources, his tax return showed that. He clearly has the ability to pay, and he has the income to pay.
But what specifically is the evidence in the record about his investment income?
Well, again, it's based upon his 2022 tax return, which showed $650,000, and a large portion of that was, I believe, investment and return from his investments. And again, I would point out that if a person has expense of $20,000 a month, clearly this gentleman has income, clearly. And that's the court relied on that, I believe.
Couldn't you be just using your savings, using assets? Why is that income? Income is a periodic payment, right, that you receive.
Well, it is. I think if
might be spending all your money down to zero. You know what I mean? But that's a different question from whether you have.
But clearly, he on his tax return in 2022, he indicated that the total, including the investments, were $650,000. And I indicated.
And how much do you know specifically? How much of that was investment income versus employment?
I believe it was at least $500,000. I don't have it off the top of my head, but I believe it's at least.
Because I'm looking at stuff that has qualified dividends, has a value, pension and annuities, taxable interest, ordinary dividends. Is that what you're talking? I mean, is that the investment income?
Yeah, it'd be on the left side of the front page of the return. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm looking at. I think that's what I'm referring to.
Okay.
And again, to overrule that, the court has to find that the trial court was clearly erroneous in its decision making.
Do we also have an asset statement in the record?
In the record?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I think we do, but I'm not sure. I know that the trial court referred to.
I mean, just wondering if the asset statement shows investments or investment accounts.
That I'm not sure, Your Honor.
Which would, you know, perhaps corroborate the tax returns. But.
There's clearly evidence in the record that the court referred to that he is owner of in multiple LLCs involving his business interests. Again, the trial court also did not find him to be credible in his assertions, and that was due to his behavior during the course of these proceedings. As the court knows, this has gone on since 2002. There have been multiple motions, multiple appeals to this court, and at least twice during these proceedings, Judge Frazier in the 2016 order indicated that the behavior of the appellant was egregious. And he reached that conclusion based on the fact that there were multiple times during the course of these extended proceedings that spouse maintenance was either suspended or terminated, or not terminated, or suspended or reduced due to his job changes, getting new jobs, et cetera. And it turned out that eventually the court found out, and we found out, that a number of times the appellant refused to disclose his current status. So, if you look at the 2016 order by Judge Frazier, he indicated that he described the behavior as egregious because it was repeated over and over again, and it harmed the respondent. It harmed her. She had to revert to a bare-bones budget for lack of money coming in because of the failure to disclose, because of the suspensions, the reductions. She had to invade her principal, and that's set forth in finding 42 of the 2016 order.
Can I ask you, if it was the case that, in fact, below, the argument was made that wife's need had substantially decreased, and that was a substantial change of circumstance. If that was the argument that was presented to the district court, and that the district court, in fact, rejected that argument in this order, we'll assume both those things are the case, can you respond substantively to that? What is wrong with the argument that her income has substantially increased from the 2016 order if you impute $7,000 as had been historically done in imputed income, and then also add the new pension and Social Security payments?
I would first indicate that it's my belief that there's no reference to the $7,000 imputing of income in this order because it was already fully considered and litigated in 2016. I think in the brief, appellant indicates that it was not considered. It was considered. I mean, it was considered and dealt with, and so therefore, when the court did its order in 2024, the court's aware of all the past orders, and since that had already been dealt with, it did not have to deal with it in this order specifically.
Did the court make a finding about her need here?
I think the court found that her needs had not changed. I believe. Perhaps implied.
And the argument is, well, really they did because now she has new income.
Well, again, so I think.
What's the new income? What impact does that new income
have? I think the new income merely replaced the old. She had a part-time job that she ended up losing because of COVID. She had to get the part-time job due to the suspensions and reductions, and due to the behavior, egregious behavior of the appellant, which resulted in that. So I think what the court did is they're equal. It was about $2,400 for the part-time jobs in 16. In 2022, the Social Security and pension was like $2,700 or $2,800. So it was basically the same. So I'm assuming, my assumption is that the court referred back and took that into consideration, and that's how it reached its decision. Because, again, the focus...
That's not in the order, is it?
It's not in the order specifically. I would also indicate that, again, the key factor is specifically a change in circumstance which makes it unreasonable and unfair. The impugning of the income had been in existence for a long time. There's no change in circumstance there. The substitution of the income from part-time to the pension was just a substitution. It didn't change the overall figure. Again, the court found in 2016 that the respondent was forced to a bare-bones budget and was forced to invade her principal because of partly in terms of the egregious actions of the appellant. And I think the court took that into consideration in making its order in this case. I would agree that some of it is implied, but I think that if you look at the whole picture, I think that's what the court did, and I think it's legitimate based on the circumstances in this case.
One of appellant's arguments is the district court erred by not counting $7,000 of investment income as in the calculation of her income. And appellant argues that because of the prior rulings throughout this case, that's law of the case, and it must be included in the income calculation now. I don't think you responded to that argument in your brief. I'm wondering if the law of the case doctrine applies, or if there's some other doctrine in family law that governs the issue.
It applies both cases. It applies initially, and it applies from the 2016 order. The court in 2016 fully considered that impugning income.
Does that bind the district court in this case upon this motion?
It does, because there's no change in circumstance. That imputing has been there the whole time. It's still there. It's no change.
Well, but the district court didn't mention it in paragraph 7.
I don't think it had to, because it doesn't constitute a change. It was
maybe
it's
now
not
I'm
change.
Un- no, I mean maybe I'm earlier misunderstood, and now I'm understanding your argument is that it's assumed that the $7,000 is added to what's mentioned in paragraph 7. Is that your argument?
Well, I think it can be assumed based upon the fact that that is what the 2016 order indicated, and it wasn't the whole focus on 2024 was change in circumstance. 2022, excuse me, was change in circumstance. There was no change in circumstance with regard to the $7,000. So that's our position. With respect to I have 10 seconds left with the second issue on my appeal. It's mandatory. The statute 518.75 subdivision 3 said if the cost of living is awarded, the effective date shall be the date it would have gone to effect if the cost of living is implemented. In this case, the judge used her discretion to move that date 18 months to the future, and since she rejected the cost of living nullification, she's mandated by the statute, by the word shall, no discretion, to use the effective date of the date when it would have been in effect had it not been objected to. That's our argument. It's in our brief. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, Ms. Kuhl, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. I want to address a couple of the factual inaccuracies first. There was a pause of spousal maintenance, but to be clear, he was required to and did pay back spousal maintenance for the majority of that time. So it's not correct to say that she had to get a job because of the spousal maintenance pause, and the trial court never made that finding, as respondent asserts here. In fact, she was already not earning the income that she should have through the investment income before the first spousal maintenance pause. So it was her own choices, and the trial court repeatedly found that it was her own financial choices that led to the lower than anticipated income for her. And that really goes to the point of, with these change of circumstances, it is substantially unjust and unfair to make husband continue to bail her out for her poor financial choices. When there's a pause in spousal maintenance, the parties are supposed to share the burden as though they are still married. Husband certainly had to cut back his expenses during that time. She apparently continued to spend recklessly. And for her to now come back and say that, while husband made good choices, he was able to still save and invest during this time, I want to take the fruits of his labor, that is unfair and unjust, and I think that's a dangerous rule for the court to adopt, that somebody can continue to spend recklessly and then rely on the obligor for a bailout when they reach retirement and don't have sources to meet their needs as they should have if they had been prudent throughout the 20-year dissolution. I also want to address a couple of things. I think that respondent acknowledged that he can't be required to use income on non-marital assets. He can't be required to use assets to pay spousal maintenance that were marital or post-marital.
Marital assets, I think he said assets acquired after the fact, from somebody that has working savvy and ability to generate income. I mean, these are assets, as I understood it, these are assets that they didn't have when they were married. This is what he did over and above.
I believe there's both. I mean, he got the same assets awarded to him that she did during the dissolution, and then he also was able to, be successful in business. And that's great for him. Wife, had the same opportunity to, do the same kinds of things with her assets that she was given in the dissolution, just as he was. They were in the same spot at the time of the dissolution. And he was able to make good financial decisions. And yes, he is in a strong financial position at this point. But that doesn't mean that he has to take her along for the ride when we're in a position now where she doesn't have need, based on her retirement and receipt of Social Security and pension and the imputed investment income, there's no need. And he doesn't have the type of income that this court considers in addressing spousal maintenance awards. So,
and just to be absolutely certain, I understand your argument that there can be we cannot consider investment income on marital assets he was awarded or on any other investments that he has post-marital. That's your argument.
Correct, because post-marital assets are his non-marital asset. He doesn't have an obligation to use those in any particular way to generate income
and
for a wife.
And on that latter point, I mean, obviously his earnings are post-marital too from employment, but you're saying also you can't consider the investment income post-maritally. And then what's your best case for that?
I don't know that I have a case to refer you to off the top of my head. But that would be the argument. And then the secondary argument is that even if you could, there's no evidence to support that he actually has income on the non-marital assets. It's never been broken down what income is from marital assets, what income is from non-marital assets. And
isn't that his burden? I mean, you have the burden on a modification to establish that.
Well, he met that burden by submitting his affidavit, which said, actually, my assets have been decreasing in the last few years. I'm not making significant income. And then it was wife's burden to rebut that, and basically all she had was speculation that he could earn income on these assets, but there was never any evidence to support that.
Do you disagree that the 2022 income tax return shows some $650,000 in non-employment income?
The 22 tax return is a little bit of a bridge because he was employed for part of the year.
Yeah.
And so it supports husband's argument. He's, taking these draws and that's spending down his assets.
I guess my question was, do you disagree it shows income in that amount? I'm just trying to understand where the points of disagreement are. Do you disagree it shows income?
I don't have the tax return in front of me, unfortunately, so I can't answer that question.
Okay.
But if there's no further questions, appellant just respectfully asks for reversal.
Thank you, Ms. Kuhl. Thank you, Mr. Escalette. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in